And honestly, I think that's an attribute of the bovine animal we don't talk about enough, at least to
Agreed,
larger
yeah.
society, is that, that ability to upcycle, to take things like, we've just in the course of this conversation, we've talked about crop residues and spent grapes and energy co-product, byproduct feeds, all being used successfully to produce protein.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed. bioMérieux is a world leader in the field of diagnostics for more than 60 years. From pathogen detection to genomics and data applications, bioMérieux helps beef industrials going beyond the test results to help control your food safety and process risks. Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.virbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm your host, Brandi Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the latest trends and issues from the best and brightest minds in the beef industry. Today, we're joined by Dr. Warren Ruschi, Assistant Professor and Extension Beef Feedlot Management Specialist at South Dakota State University. Dr. Ruschi earned his master's in animal science from Kansas State University and his PhD in animal science from South Dakota State University. I'm really excited to talk to him today. I have a lot in common with what he works with every day, and so I'll probably geek out, folks. You just have to prepare yourself for it. But we're kicking off 2025 with a great conversation about integration of crops and livestock. So let's dive right in. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Ruschi. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
I geek out, and the last episode I recorded a few weeks ago, I didn't get to any of the questions that we had planned with that guest because we started talking about direct market to beef, and we took off to the races. And so I will try to contain my excitement around different topics that we're doing so we can really dig down into your expertise. But I love talking cattle. I love talking about beef production. And so just really excited to have you on the podcast today. To start off with, I talked about like a very small amount of your background, right? But I'd love to hear more about your background, how you got started in the beef industry, and kind of your career path so far.
Well, my career path has been pretty long and windy, so this could actually take up a big chunk of your podcast. But you mentioned my master's degree at Kansas State. That's honestly the only time in my life I've lived outside of South Dakota. I'm a South Dakota boy, grew up about 60 miles west of Brookings, South Dakota, or west of where I'm at right now, in a diversified crop livestock operation, pretty typical of our neighbors. We had a cow-calf herd. Our family has done some cattle feeding, custom backgrounding. When I was in, through undergraduate, we had a sheep flock. Started off growing a lot of, small grains, wheat, barley, oats, hay, and so forth. And then over time, that enterprise has turned into, corn and soybeans. So I'm really, really steeped in that whole, we grow things and we turn them into cash by walking it off a farm from livestock. I tell people I am not an agronomist. I can speak corn farmer, but, deep down, I was always much, much happier in the barn, in the pens. Having to drive the tractor was a little bit of a form of punishment for me, but certainly get it. And that's, I've taken some of that approach and, done that to what I do with my extension role. Is try to help our producers figure out ways to take the resources we grow here, whether that's pasture, grass, or now my current role, harvested feedstuffs, grains, processing byproducts, and turn that into the best quality protein source that we've ever found, beef.
All that tracks. I also do not speak corn farmer. I don't really speak any farmer. We live in Southeast Kansas, and we own about 60 some acres. And of that 6.5 or something like that, 7 acres is crop ground. And then we lease another maybe 30 acres of crop ground. And then we rent or lease whatever term you want to use, like 700 grass acres. So there's not a lot of farming running through my bones. We custom hire it all out. I know when you plant corn and when it should be harvested and you know, I know a decent amount about silage, but like, I'm not even going to pretend to be a farmer. That's not my thing. I'm like you. I want to be in the barn with the animals and things like that.
Yeah. That's kind of, has been my story too. But one of the things though, here in South Dakota, where we do, those businesses are so integrated that it makes what I do from a professional standpoint so interesting, because every cattle background or cattle feeder, every one of them do things just a little different in terms of almost always there's some crops along with that. How that looks may depending on whether I'm here on the east side of the state or if I'm visiting producers farther west, some of that mix might change. In a lot of cases, they also have a cow herd. And so we really, we really dive into the complexity of diversified enterprises and how all of those moving parts have to fit. And so, it from a professional standpoint, when I work with cattle feeders here, it keeps things super interesting. I think I would be bored in the Texas Panhandle. It'd be like steam flake corn and cotton gin trash. Ooh, here I get to work with high moisture corn and earlige and various varieties of silage and dry corn, and we've done work from our research and extension standpoint. We've done things like feeding rye grain to cattle, and we've done some work now with soybean co-products. So we really get to embrace all of the different variations of how we can turn plant material into beef.
You said something that I have not ever heard before, and I'm going to blame this on me not being a farmer. Earlige.
Oh, sure.
I need to know what this is.
So that is, it's essentially ear corn, and it's chopped up and harvested as a high moisture feed stuff. And so what we have is it's got the corn, but then also the cob might have, depending on the equipment, it may have the leaves and husks and part of the shank. And what it's a really versatile feed because we get the grain, but we also get some of the roughage. It's from a cattle feeding standpoint, it's one of our favorite ingredients because it's really user-friendly from a standpoint of if we get off in terms of amounts, maybe we fed more grain than we were supposed to, but we're also feeding a little more roughage. So from that standpoint, it's pretty safe. It's pretty versatile. We can get the roughage and the grain part of the diet in one feedstuff rather than two. And so it's relatively common here in the upper Midwest. It's somewhat scale dependent. It's much harder to put up, if you were one of the really large feedlots in Southwest Kansas or the Texas Panhandle, logistically, they have a hard time doing that. Our smaller scaled operations here in the upper north or the northern Great Plains, it's much easier to pull off, especially when those businesses control their corn acres and the cattle. So from that standpoint, it's a bit of a regional thing, and because it fits our business structure as much as anything else.
So is it different than silage? Because it doesn't sound much different than just like normal corn silage.
The difference is how much of the plant we harvest and the timing.
Okay.
So if you think about from a calendar standpoint, the first opportunity to harvest is going to be corn silage, where we take the entire plant.
Mm-hmm.
Earlige is the next one.
Okay.
It takes as the crop matures and the grain gets slightly drier. Now we have an opportunity to take earlige. Then it's high moisture corn, where now it's essentially just like dry shelled corn, only at a higher moisture content. And then after that, once that gets too dry to do that optimally, now we're looking at dry corn. So some of what we do from a research standpoint is looking at all of those different options and how do we take those different approaches and figure out what are the better alternative. What are the approaches to success using those? One of the challenges that you might have maybe picked up is those stages aren't discrete. They overlap and it happens very, very quickly.
Yes.
You can be perfect, ideally for silage, and a week later, now it's earlige, and trying to accomplish all that at the same time is really challenging. So one of the things we work at is, looking at how do we use some of these different feedstuffs, and what Dr. Smith and I focus is on the nutritional side, and then we can take that information. Now we can cattle feeders can use that to think about, all right, what, here's what we know from how cattle will perform on these feeds. This is what we have in terms of limitations on labor and equipment and everything else. And now we can sort of like making a casserole. Now we can start combining things in coming up with what for our operation is the right recipe.
Right. So the timing thing that you talk about, that is front and center in my life most summers, or kind of like late summer. For the past 3 years, I've requested, or I've kind of been told my husband, like, it would be really nice if we could chop silage, like, while I am here, because I video it for, you know, video content on the internet and things like that. And like two of the last 3 years, it has happened while I have been on a work trip. And so I'm trying to like hire someone to come and video, because it's never like the right moisture content happens whether you're ready for it or not. You've got to chop it when it's ready. And so you're speaking it exactly my language with that, for sure.
And now too, it also, you know, at least here, so much of what we do from corn silage is now done by custom hire operators. And so mm-hmm. It's also the timing of when can they get to you. And you know, we did a study using Earlage, and frankly, we were a little late. It got away from us through no one's fault. It's just the timing, and it fed fine. We're pretty confident in the results, but in an ideal world, we were probably a week too late in terms of getting the right moisture content. It packed and kept well enough, but it was drier than what we would have preferred.
And that happened, like I told you before we came on air, that, you know, we own like 7 acres of crop ground, and then we rent lease another like 30. So I cannot justify the cost of a chopper, right? Or a drill or a planter or anything like that. So we're at the behest of a custom crew. And when they're ready, the crew we've used the last few years has just been phenomenal. They do such a great job. I cannot speak any more highly of them. But when they're ready, they're ready. And so it's out of our control a lot. And that's just part of the way our operation works. But you mentioned earlier a little bit about talking about like these home-raised feedstuffs. And so in your opinion, I know that you work with this, like this is what you do every day. How, as people, you were speaking about people who have crop ground and they have cows, like how can we as producers best utilize a home-raised feedstuff in growing and finishing cattle?
Well, it starts with taking a look at what is it that you can grow well, and then start building systems from there. I grew up in that kind of integrated world where we crop farmed, but we also had cattle. So what decisions that got made for part of it affected everything else. So I think of that whole scope of the question is part of a system, and that's now how do we make things fit from a nutrition standpoint. What we do at least here is we start with what you produced, and then we supplement or strategize around it appropriately. If for instance it was one of those years where we had a lot of corn we had to harvest for silage because of drought stress, whatever, then what we're going to do is going to maximize how we can use silage. If there was perhaps a year where that wasn't the case and we had really ideal growing conditions, and perhaps that operation says we're going to minimize how much silage we want to put up because we're going to emphasize harvesting grain corn, then we're going to shift accordingly. So it's what keeps things interesting. But from a cattle or farm system management standpoint, it really comes down to what do we have, and then how do we fill those gaps most economically. We're fortunate here that we have access to really a pretty wide variety of alternative or byproduct type feeds. Distillers is pretty widely available, but we also have things like soybean meal and other co-products. Roughage is getting more challenging as we grow less alfalfa and less hay, but it's still, we're fortunate enough, we still can get that. And we make use of a lot of things like crop residues, corn stalks, wheat straw, corn stocks being the major one. That's probably been one of the biggest changes in agriculture from when I was a kid is, at least in eastern South Dakota, we produce much less wheat and small grains, and it's mostly corn and soybeans. So we've adapted our systems to use the feeds that we do grow in order to run those through cow herds or through cattle lots.
I think that's a really good testament to agriculture in general is when something changes, we find a way to use, you know, to adapt and use it. I know there's a saying, you know, that says like in cattle production, cattle processing, we use everything but the moo. And the same goes from like, you know, feeding up to or leading up to feeding them, like corn, feeding corn stalks is a great way, is a great testament to that. We butt up right against our property, butts up right against what used to be a feedlot. And the man who bought the feedlot, the bunks and the shades are actually at my house now. And we bought them from him, and he turned the whole field, or the whole property that the feedlot was on into, crop ground. And so he does no-till soybeans, 2 years, and he does a year of corn. And for a long time, we would run our cows on those corn stalks because like it improves the land. And then you're also getting feed, like a valuable feed stuff out of those corn stalks. The only downside for us was that my husband traveled a lot during the time that they were grazing on those. And I was constantly having to put cattle back on the other side, like the correct side of the hot fence, because the sun doesn't shine in January, February. So the hot fence doesn't work as well, but it's a great, great feed stuff and a way to be really efficient with something that's already there.
I kind of glossed over some stuff on my background, but I spent about 12 years on our family's operation. Kind of on the day to day, you know, my wife and I had cows along with my dad. We custom fed cattle, and our secret weapon from a cow standpoint was our ability to use corn stalks. And so I sort of smiled when you talked about the the solar panels and the fencing. I learned fairly fast that didn't work. We didn't have enough sun, so I had a collection of marine deep cycle batteries that I kept charged up and kept in rotation because. We just had, you know, we were between what our family owned and what we could rent from other neighbors. We've covered a lot of corn ground. And in fact, I was just on a phone call with a producer this morning that we've been fortunate enough. It's been winter, but it hasn't been that bad. He is just now starting to feed some of his cows. They've spent the whole fall on either cover crops or crop residue. And, you know, so when we can do that, especially here where our winters can be varied.
Brutal.
In terms of, and this year, of course, the cynical part of me and growing up here thinks we're going to pay for this sooner or later. But for now, I think probably this week compared to a lot of your listeners, we're pretty blessed. We've had a few inches of snow, nothing out of the ordinary. My wife's a school teacher. She got out early one day. So travel hasn't been an issue. We've had really pretty good conditions. It's a little cold today. It's, either side is zero, but, it is South Dakota. That's kind of our, when we can do that, man, that is our secret weapon in terms of taking cost out of the cow business by relying on those resources that the corn budget paid for. All we now have to do is, go out and might take a little work, fencing, hauling water, all those things. In terms of just letting the cows do what they know how to do, and that's to use some of those feedstuffs that otherwise would go unused.
You mentioned this earlier. You were talking about co-products. I think you mentioned DDGs. And so biofuels are something that have come on. I don't really know when the first biofuel was emerged onto the market. But those have caused a big change to the way we raise crops or what crops we raise and what amount across the Midwest and kind of in the plains. So what changes, like how do changes in biofuels and like the production of those change protein supplementation strategies? So like, we have used a lot of DDGs here because I live where there's a lot of corn grown and there's actually an ethanol plant 8 miles from my house. So how does that kind of change protein and what we feed and those kind of things?
So in the short term, it hasn't changed things a lot. We still, We rely on distiller's grains, either in the modified wet or dried form, is, at least on the cattle side, almost exclusively. What's going to be interesting going forward is what happens on the soybean side. We've 5 or 6 years ago, there was one large soybean crush plant in South Dakota and another small one. Now they've there's been a second one that's operational and a third one under construction. So we are going to process more soybeans. So what that does in terms of supplemental protein remains to be seen. And we've done some research on, using soybean meal as a replacement for distillers, because, we don't know ultimately economics going to drive this. Tell me what the relative price is between those two ingredients and we'll tell you which one makes sense to use. But, yes. And so we're collecting the data so that, people ask me, we'll do some, for instance, we've just completed and published some studies replacing distillers with soybean meal and with some varying results. In the first study, it didn't make much difference. In another, as we added more soybean meal, we improved performance and we saw some really interesting results by feeding soybeans where some of soybean meal, where some of the oil stayed because it was the expeller processed and saw improved performance there. And people ask, well, what's the economic and I can't give them the answer because I don't know, those things are dynamic. But I'm old enough. I don't know how well it shows up in my picture, but if you look at the hairline, I place myself as someone not especially young anymore. I remember when distillers became the feedstuff here, at least in South Dakota. It was fairly, it was kind of a niche product. And then over time, as as the ethanol boom kicked in, it changed everything in terms of now we have all this distillers available. At that time, it was super, super cheap because we didn't quite know how to use it. Now that we've learned how and the ethanol plants have figured out what it's worth, it's fairly priced, not cheap anymore.
Yeah.
It also, though, it took out, I used to be able to buy a lot of alfalfa hay. Can't anymore, or shouldn't say can't, but a whole lot less alfalfa got grown. We took it out of the rotation, replaced it with corn. So it remains to be seen what will happen on the soybean front. My crystal ball is not necessarily very good, but if I had to make a guess, I would say it's still going to be the same story where swine and poultry are going to take up a lot of that. But what I think it's going to do is then perhaps create some more opportunities for us to use less expensive distillers as those industries gravitate more towards the soybean meal to replace synthetic amino acids that might give us some additional distiller supply. But, so much of what we do is, if you look at the corn market, so much of it is driven by what's going on in the biofuel the fuel side of the equation now.
Right.
So it creates some complications, but it also really lets us take advantage of the bovine's niche in terms of being able to use all those different feeds that, swine folks really can't, or the poultry can't use some of the things we can do nearly to the extent we can. So, what that does is it means we become somewhat the feed user of the last one in the line. We take what others can't use, and then to a large extent, and then you add value to it that way.
That's for sure. You're speaking about like cattle being, I'm going to use the word like adaptable again, but they are adaptable, which goes hand in hand with cattle producers. I mean, just taking something that maybe wasn't necessarily designed for cattle, but it can be a functional feed. I know that co-products that we're talking about, we're talking about DDGs and soybean meal, but there's, depending on where you're at and in the United States, something I love about the beef industry is like co-products could be like spent grapes or, like tomato skins or something like that. And those things were obviously not designed for cattle to be eating, but the wonderful thing about cattle and their digestive system, and I do not have a PhD in nutrition or in, I guess, physiology technically, their digestive system can really utilize those. And I think that that's something that we kind of take for granted. Like we all know that, but we don't really talk about it as much, but like, I don't know, my chickens will not eat like smushed grapes, but I know the cattle will. And so it's just, it's a really wonderful asset that we have in the beef industry.
And honestly, I think that's an attribute of the bovine animal we don't talk about enough, at least in larger society, is that, you know, that ability to upcycle, to take things like, you know, we've just in the course of this conversation, we've talked about crop residues and spent grapes and energy co-product, byproduct feeds, all being used successfully to produce protein. And I think sometimes the general public and or the folks that aren't necessarily our friends tend to look at our business and say, well, look, they're taking all this food that could go to humans and we're putting it through this beef animal who's not always as efficient as maybe the chicken is. But what they fail to count for is we're feeding them things that no one else can use. You know, and there was a quote, and I don't remember who said this, but he was someone that was on campus here, and he talked about taking nature we can't use, that people can't use, and turning it into nature that we can. You know, and that's really our niche, and I think that's something we need to champion more than we do, is the ruminant's ability to upcycle feeds.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. It's something that we kind of go through phases of talking about it, and then we don't. But like, we always have an audience for those things, and just repeatedly talking about those. Oh gosh, you touched on something and now I have forgotten it. But just a great point all around that those cattle really do utilize those things that are not going to be, they're going to be wasted. That's what I was going to go on. Like for example, like spent grapes from a winery, like if that isn't fed the cattle, those just go to a landfill and then they emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And then that contributes to more climate change and more environmental issues. And so one of the amazing characteristics is that as an industry, we can utilize those things and feed the cattle and have a very high quality nutrient dense protein and help other agricultural and food industries offset their, you know, carbon impact or their climate impact. And I think that that's, again, you said it perfectly, we have got to continue talking about it and making that be, you know, a pillar that we get out there for people to understand. So we talked a little bit earlier about this, and I want to come back to it because I said I was going to geek out about it, but you talk about all these crops and integrations. And so I'd love to talk a little bit about agronomic yieldability between corn silage and sorghum silage. We have been feeding sorghum silage for 2 to 3 years, a drought resistant variety. And we have loved it. We have just absolutely loved the way our cattle have performed on it. We have a cow-calf herd, plus we do feeder cattle, and we have just loved it. So is there anything you want to talk about in terms of cattle performance between those two silage, you know, different silage products?
And it just so happens we're going to start a research project on that this spring. Depends on when the pens open up and when we can get cattle in. But you know, we've never really compared the two. And honestly, you know, I think we can probably predict fairly well what would happen nutritionally when we do that. To me, the interesting part is how does that fit into the larger system. So one of the things we're going to look at, and this is. We get to do some things that are maybe seem a little weird, but I also know some producers are doing that. We work with one of the university's research farms located south of Sioux Falls, where we have a cattle feedlot there, and then also they have about 3/4 of crop ground. And so we planted corn for silage, or then we planted intercropped within the same planter, sorghum and corn in either 75-25 or 50-50 blends.
Okay.
And what our idea is as you said, in terms of drought tolerance, sorghum absolutely wins. In terms of energy per acre, corn silage is going to win. But it's not always cheap to grow. In fact, never is. And also from a standpoint of thinking about environmental risk, it's more sensitive than sorghum is. One of the challenges we have with sorghum is it's really hard to get that harvested dry enough as silage. It tends to be wetter than, at least here, wetter than what we'd like. It's a bit of a challenge. So what our thought is, if we planted the two within as kind of a companion, we can let the corn get just a little more mature, a little drier than maybe the ideal target, accumulate more starch. At the same time, we've got this sorghum that's coming along for the ride that's probably wetter than it needs to be. And we'll harvest the two together and maybe come up with something that's closer to ideal. So we're looking at it from the standpoint of what does that do from a cattle growth. We're also then going to look at that and then tie that into, we've got yield data, which I don't know off the top of my head how those plots yielded, but our colleagues down at the farm do. And then we'll be able to come back and say, what does this do in terms of beef production per acre? What was our cost per unit of dry matter for that feed? And then really kind of take a holistic look at what we're doing on a crop livestock system with these different combinations. For us, the cool part of the sorghum is it lets us also do things like plant some winter annuals. We've done some work with rye, either as a forage or as a grain crop. We did our team here, and this was part of my PhD program. It was some of the first research on feeding hybrid rye in North America. And it works out so nicely that we can, especially if we harvest that as forage, we can come back in and get a summer crop planted and really get three crops in 2 years, which for us, as far north as we are, that's hard to do. I know probably in your area and farther south, that double cropping is easier to pull off. We're limited by growing season. So when we can start integrating summer and winter annuals and produce a lot of roughage off of a land base with less cost than what we would do if we were planting corn, from a big picture system standpoint, it comes out a winner.
I think that's a really good point about the two crops in your 3 and 2 years. That's just really valuable to get the most out of your land. We have actually, we didn't do it this year, but the year before we pulled the sorghum silage off for sorghum. And then we did plant rye as a winter cover crop. And then we actually baled it, cut it or chopped it and then baled it instead of putting it in a pile. We baled it and had those bales wrapped. And I would say it was semi-successful. We had a really rainy spring when we did that, and the land that we put the rye on does not drain well. I live in a floodplain, and so it was really hard to get it to dry down enough, but I would say it was semi-successful. But I could see how, if I lived much further north, Sioux Falls, I know that you're not in Sioux Falls, but Sioux Falls is 5 hours north of me. So that's a big geographical difference in terms of winter and things like that. So that makes sense. Back to your, I had never thought or even heard of planting the forage sorghum and the corn together based on, I think that is remarkable. Very, very interesting. Which one do you use as the measurement to chop it? Are you going off of the corn moisture or the sorghum moisture?
Well, that's a great question. I think the way I would look at it is we look at then what is the, and that may be something we have to, think about in version two of this, but ultimately it's going to be what is the moisture content of the biomass coming off of it, because that's what we need to target in terms of fermentation. So that makes it harder to do, because I think we're all used to, at least I am. I think of, I can tell fairly close, go grab an ear of corn, break it open. Where are we as far as the milk line? That's going to tell me. Now with that silage, with the sorghum silage part of that, that isn't going to be, that might be more challenging to do. But my suspicion is we'll probably, let's say if it was a 50-50 blend, and this is spitballing gut call, but I would take the corn just a little more mature than I otherwise would have, because in reality, that sorghum silage might struggle to be over 30% dry matter. So it's going to be marginal as far as being able to keep that harvested and ferment well. But if it's 30 and our corn silage is maybe 45% dry matter, all of a sudden now we kind of meet in the middle and we've got something pretty close to right. That's one of the things I think we're going to look at, is just to see how sensitive the moisture is, as things mature. That's one of the things we're going to look at. Again, we'll see what happens from a cattle performance standpoint. But to me, the more interesting question is, what does this do over a period of years in terms of a system.
I just find that so interesting. Just feeding, like, one is drought tolerant and one needs a lot of water. And so that's, I just find that really interesting. If you're waiting a bit on the corn, and I do know what the milk line is, so I have to make sure I say that I do know what the milk line is on corn. But if you're waiting, if you're waiting to get that to a little bit more dry matter on the corn, are you then getting closer to, if the corn was by itself, would be closer to earlidge kind of quality?
Almost. What we're, and the University of Nebraska has done some work on, when they will harvest corn at a little more advanced maturity, and it really enhances the amount of energy we get, because that corn plant is accumulating more and more starch all the time. So one of our thoughts might be is that blend, especially as we let corn get just a little more mature, it might not, if this is corn silage and this is sorghum, you'd think it'd be here, but maybe it's here. Maybe mm-hmm. we get a little bit of bump because of that extra starch content, and it feeds closer to corn silage than what the raw averages would suggest. We'll see. Ask me again, probably in July, and I'll be able to tell you.
Well, I will be shaded up in July at 1 p.m. on a normal July day at 1 o'clock. I'm not outside, so we will have the opportunity. I will get you back on the schedule for the middle of the day in July.
And that we can talk great. About it then.
Well, we're coming kind of to the end, but I want to make sure for as entrenched in cattle feeding and crops as you are and those two integrations, I do want to ask, like, where do you see cattle finishing in 10 years from now? Is it roughly the same or vastly different, or like maybe in the middle? I know you said that your crystal ball isn't that great earlier, but I think that your crystal ball is better than probably 75 or 80% of the people involved in the industry, because you do this every day. So, kind of what's your opinion?
Well, and this might, what I'm going to say may, depending on the geography of your, the people watching or listening to this may or may not agree with, but I think that cattle feeding in the upper Midwest has a tremendous potential for a couple reasons. First and foremost, we really don't rely on irrigation water. Where I grew up, when I was a kid, we thought it was a big, big deal when we cracked 100 bushel corn. I mean, that was something. Now my neighbors are doing 200 bushel plus, and there isn't an irrigation well to be found. So we're going to be really competitive at growing feed for a very long time, where in some places that are relying on the Ogallala, they may either find water availability isn't what it had been, or they're getting priced out. And my colleagues in the panhandle tell me that's already happening with corn silage. So the dairies they're sucking up all the corn silage, and it's leaving the cattle feeders to feed something else. The other thing too is, our feed costs are just so much less. If I compare what corn is worth here compared to when I visit my counterparts in Kansas or Texas, we're considerably less expensive. Mm-hmm. So I think, we've got a real bright future. We have to deal with weather. As we've talked about, we get the cold, we get the hot, and everything in between, and we deal with mud. But I really think that, I'm not at the end of my career, but I can see it. It's coming. But I work with people at the beginning of theirs, and we've talked. We think we're in one of the best places to be doing this kind of work in all of North America is here in South Dakota, and this. Take that 150-mile circle around Sioux Falls, Sioux City, and it's just a really vibrant place to feed cattle and to grow livestock.
Well, it'll be interesting to see when you do arrive at your end of your career to see how far. And I don't know how many years that is. I'm just going off of what you said that you can kind of see it.
I think it's about 12. It all depends. Or as soon as I can afford not to. It depends on the day.
So it'll be interesting just to see, how it kind of progresses, because, change is inevitable. And so I think we've come so far and change is, I think that when we're in the moment, we don't realize how much changes, but when you look back over a period of 5 years or 10 years, there's a lot that has taken place. So
it's time for our famous three. Your cattle are constantly threatened by the exposure of mycotoxins in feed.
Now you can know if mycotoxins are present in your feed and what you should do about it. DSM Firmenich offers a range of analytical services to assess the mycotoxin contamination and solutions to combat mycotoxins. Don't let mycotoxins contaminate your performance. Visit dsmfirmenich.com/mycotoxin-survey to learn more. That's dsm-firmenich.com/mycotoxin-survey.
Well, I want to get to our last three questions. To our audience, I ask the same questions of every guest, and I don't just spring these on our guests. I do give them to them in advance so that it's not just kind of like deer in the headlight. So but we ask as of everybody. So the first one is, what is your favorite beef or cattle related resource? It could be a book or a website. I had one guest who said that his wife was his favorite beef cattle related resource because he managed like the data side of the business and his wife did the genetics. So what is yours?
I was thinking of that when you'd posed that, and I struggled to come up with a single one, but you kind of saved me here on your last comment. I think my favorite resources are the people I get to talk to. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate and blessed to have had a wide variety of influencers and mentors, and now I'm on the other side of the fence where I'm a mentor to our grad students and some of our younger team members, but I learned something from so many people all the time in terms of whether on the seed stock or cow calf or cattle feeding side. I'm a bit of a student of history. So, one of the books on my shelf is, can't read with my eyes. It's Feeding Beef Cattle, basically. Dr. Matsushima, one of the pioneers in our industry. Basically he invented steam flake corn.
Wow.
When he was at, and I think is still, I'm going to get the age wrong. He's in his 90s, if not older.
Okay.
And as I understand, still shows up in Fort Collins and at the Animal Science Department. He's just one of the examples of people that I like to study to say, the ones that really have been kind of the pathfinders for our industry. And then the current trailblazers, the ones I like to visit with.
Yeah, people are definitely not an untapped resource, but there's a lot to be said for just sitting and listening for those to what other people have learned and experienced. We can gain a wealth of information and knowledge just from other people. All right, the next question is, what is your favorite non-beef or cattle-related book or one that you are currently reading?
Well, currently reading, I struggle with getting enough reading done outside of what I have to do for work. But the one that I can think of that's on my shelf that I probably need to pull down again and go back through it. I'm a huge fan of the book Good to Great, in terms of mm-hmm. thinking about organizations and leadership and everything else. That's been one that really was influential to me when I first read that when I was on our family's farm, and it helped change some of how I approached how to manage things, and it's influenced what I do here in terms of thinking about what is it I can be the best at, doing what plays to my strengths. And so it's, that's been a real influential resource for me, as I've grown, I guess, as an individual.
That's not the first time I've heard someone mention how wonderful that book is. I think my husband actually has that book. I have not read it. I can't claim that I have, but I know my husband has read it. And so he was that's a Malcolm Gladwell book, right?
No, Jim Collins. Although I've read a lot of Malcolm Gladwell as well, and that would be some of the other ones that in terms of that have kind of shaped how I think about things. That he'd be another author.
Malcolm Gladwell has a really good podcast as well. It's like I think it's called Revisionist History, and it's really good. I don't know if you listen to podcasts or not. I hope you do because you're on one.
I need to start more. I've not been. I'm kind of the get in the car and get turn on some mindless music and sing along. That's been always kind of my go-to, but maybe I'm showing my age or generation thing, but I'm not as big of a podcast. I shouldn't say this cause I'm on one and I've been on several,
okay.
But, I'm kind of a music and then read. That's kind of my two ways I get. If I'm listening, it's music. And if I need to learn things, it's reading more often.
Well, not every medium is for every person. That's just the way it works. I cannot listen to books on tape when I'm in, because I start thinking about other things and I'm not listening anymore. So if I listen to a podcast, it's while I'm running, because then that's like, you know, doing some sort of running. So I get it. Not everything is for every person, and there's nothing wrong with that. So the last one is, when you think of someone you admire or look up to, what is a characteristic they possess that has led them to be successful?
You know, the people I can think of that, you know, I look up to as, you know, mentors or, you know, people I'd like to be when I grew up, you know, integrity is number one. You know, do I have confidence that what they tell me that I can go to the bank with it? You know, that to me is, you know, absolute, almost that's a non-negotiable, aspect. The other part is probably curiosity. You know, I think people that are, you know, always learning, always interested in what's new. You know, we talked a little bit mm-hmm. about my, you know, time at Kansas State. My major advisor is Dr. Larry Cora, who's someone I still consider. I tell people I want to be Dr. Cora when I grow up. You know, and that he had both of those, you know, in terms of integrity, mm-hmm. but also just an incredibly curious man. You know, a wonderful, you know, he collaborated with everybody. I consider myself incredibly fortunate to have been at K-State there in the early 90s when you had Dr. Cora, but also Dr. Sims, Dr. Cool, Dr. Cochran, Harmon, Brandt. I mean, it was a murderer's yeah. row of beef cattle scientists that I got to learn from. And, you know, they used to, a group of them, you know, would invite grad students to come with them on Friday afternoon. They went out to the little, one of the little neighborhood places about a block or two from where I lived and have burgers. And, you know, I just got to sit back and listen. And I've told people since, that was the best graduate class I ever took, that I didn't have to pay tuition for. I didn't have to take a test. Just listening to those gentlemen, you know, talk about what they saw in the beef industry, you know, it was really as a, you know, early 20 something young man at the time, you know, was just really incredibly valuable to me. And so those are some of the people that, you know, I've tried to, you know, now that I'm, you know, I'm supposed to be now more of a seasoned veteran. Those are the kind of people I try to emulate.
Yeah. I can only imagine the conversations and the wisdom that were shared there. My husband, when we were in grad school at K-State, he played hearts with a lot of the professors during their lunchtime. So it wasn't with that group of professors. It was with a different group of professors, but he would say the same thing, that like, that was an invaluable time, just kind of like soaking up all of that knowledge and just experience and lessons that they were able to share over playing cards. So that's also just wonderful memories for you to have and look back on, you know, throughout your career and your personal life.
Someone's told me, I think there's still a group of those guys get together and play cards every noon. So
they do. I'm sure they still do, because there's a lot of them that would still be there. So we were in grad school in the early 2010s. And a lot of them they're not all still there, but other new ones have added to the group as others have retired and such. So I'm sure that they still do that. That is all the questions in time. I could talk to you for a lot longer about sorghum silage and beef production. But I want to be cognizant of your time. So you'll have to come back in July when it's really hot outside. But thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rushi. If listeners have questions for you or want to learn more about our discussion today, where can they do that?
Sure. I'm going to direct them to our extension website first, and that's extension.sdstate.edu. You know, and if they look under our experts, they can find me. If they want to email me directly, it's warren.rushe, and that's RUSCHE@sdstate.edu. Also on our website, would list like my office phone number. That goes to my cell phone because I could never figure out how to make voicemail work here. So, I am a telemarketer's dream because I never know who's calling. And so I tend to answer every phone call, and you end up with some really interesting, you know, conversations. I had a rancher from Oklahoma call me up once, and he had seen something I'd written, and I said, and I was thinking to myself, well, this is going to go one of two directions. He either liked it or he hated it. But he actually agreed with me. So I felt smart that day. But yeah, so if anyone has any kind of questions, if you go to our website, that will let you find me.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing those. I have, for our listening audience, I have put both the extension website and Dr. Rushi's email. I put those in the show notes, so those will be at the bottom when you're scrolling on your phone or on your computer that you can find those. Thank you again, Dr. Rushi, for joining us. I have just really appreciated and enjoyed talking to you. Thank you to our audience for being here and for tuning in. And we will meet you back here next week on the Beef Podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.